Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 17th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I am recording this right now, live from my hotel room in Chicago, here on a film shoot, and the internet is not great in this hotel, but that's okay, because hopefully this comes through to you loud and clear. Guys, I want to thank you for supporting the show each week. You know that Talk Nerdy is and will always be, I say that the same way every week, it is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because of the support from listeners like yourself. The top supporters this week on Patreon are Rob Schreck, Timothy Glover, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, the Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Hermio Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you would like to hear your name called out at the top of the show, just go to patreon.com/talknerdy and see about pledging your support. And of course, guys, you can pledge as little as a dollar. Everything helps. That is how the show keeps chugging along. All right, I want to dive into the episode this week. Ooh, it's a good one. It's the first time in a while that I had the opportunity to sit down in studio, and I was really honestly blessed to be graced with the presence of Mara Altman. She's an incredible journalist. She has written a ton of stuff, 8 best-selling Kindle singles, a whole bunch of pieces, you know, for the New York Times, Salon, New York Magazine. She used to work for The Village Voice. She previously wrote a book called Thanks for Coming, and we're going to talk about her newest book. It's so good. It's called Gross Anatomy, Dispatches from the Front and Back, and it's available now wherever books are sold. So guys, without any further ado, here she is, the hilarious Mara Altman. Well, Mara, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me here.
I'm so excited. It's been quite a while since I've had somebody come into studio, which sounds so professional. It's just a room in my house, but
it looks professional.
Thank you.
It's very nice.
I'm actually actively reorganizing all of my books right now, so it's kind of a hot mess in here, but you're very sweet for, I don't know, wading through the mess. So we are going to talk about your book today, Gross Anatomy, Dispatches from the Front and Back.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, you would say that this all started with Bearded Lady, which was an essay that you wrote.
Yeah.
And where was that published?
It was a Kindle single. So it was on Amazon.
Oh, cool.
And it did very well. And I had a lot of feedback. It was very cool. So it was about being a really hairy girl.
Nice.
And the kind of bookend to it was that I was getting married and I really wanted to tell my fiance finally that I had chin hair, because I was sick of hiding it. It was like I'd be outside and I would just be thinking about how like the sun was hitting my chin and it'd be like shimmering and blinding him. And I would just do crazy things like tear up my appointment cards for laser. And, you know, it was like just a really anxiety, a lot of anxiety around it. So I was like, it's just time to tell him and then he can deal with it however he wants, you know, and I can stop having this crazy.
And how did he take it?
Well, I mean, it's not the cliffhanger. No.
Isn't that such a funny thing that like we care so much more than other people?
Yeah. I mean, it's really that. It was really much more an issue to me than it was to him. I went through months of research, talking to, you know, all sorts of different researchers, evolutionary theorists, anthropologists, women's gender professors, like you name it. I talked to them. Cindy Barshop, who was like on The Real Housewives, and she like owns a whole salon. She gets rid of hair for a living. and after all this, you know, I tell my soon to be husband while we're watching, what was it, SVU?
I love SVU. Yeah.
For some reason, it was like that moment I had to tell him. We're watching like that one where some voyeur like has a camera in a restroom and he likes to watch people pee, but instead he like witnesses some horrible, you know, crime. And I'm like, now's the moment. I'm gonna tell him about my chin hair. And he looks over at me. I'm like, I have to tell you something. And I just like go, tweezers and this and that. And And he's like, it's just hair. And he like turns back and keeps watching. It was just amazing.
I love it. And it's so funny too, because I think we forget as women, we have this, I mean, we're going to be talking about this the whole time, but like this standard in our minds, whether it's sort of a combination, right? Of like parental influence, societal influence, beauty influence, but also like this weird self-conscious sort of, and there's biological reasons, you know, these evolutionary, but we forget sometimes, especially women who are in like cisgendered women who are in heterosexual relationships, we forget that like dudes be hairy and like they're used to this shit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, my husband's really not that observant anyway. Like one little hair, he doesn't even notice when I have like a volcanic pimple, you know? It was, yeah.
And so do you now, are you a groomer? Are you somebody whose process changed throughout writing these essays?
Yeah, I mean, for each of one of them has a different issue. So there's like, you know, sweat and sex sounds and there's vaginal scent and hemorrhoids and just all sorts of fun stuff. But for hair, definitely it changed. Like it didn't, in the essay, I try and grow out all my hair because I'm like, maybe the way to do it is just like embrace it all. Not the chin hair, though, because I was like, that'll just be traumatizing for me. I don't want to see it at its full expression. You know, I just don't know what's going to happen. So, but everything else, like I did the unibrow, which was disappointing because it wasn't like full Frida, but it also wasn't like, it was like this middle ground. People are like, what are you trying to do?
I think that's how it is for a lot of women, right? Yeah. Like Frida Kahlo has like a very special thing going on.
I know.
But a lot of women were not quite what they look like in the magazines, but we're also not quite like circus.
Full unibrow. Yeah. I was really hoping I could really do it. And I think it was kind of cool. I liked it, but I was just disappointed about the very middle part. I just didn't totally bridge it. And, you know, Frida really owns the unibrow. So if you let your unibrow grow out, like you're trying to be her.
Yeah.
You can't just have your like natural eyebrows and be.
Yeah, I feel like there was a woman recently, like a model in Eastern Europe or something like that, who models for like big clothing designers. And she was like, fuck it, I'm going to have a unibrow. And it's like crazy controversial, right?
Yeah.
There's like all this love, but then all this hate all over the internet. And it's, why do people care so much?
I don't know.
So weird.
I know. But, so I grew out the hair on the legs and the armpits, and like one of my cool, very cool revelations with the armpit hair was like I was naked and I like held up my arms and I looked in the mirror and I was like, oh my God, I have two decoy vaginas. I'm like, this is amazing. This must have been useful at some point in history.
What does armpit hair do? These are biological questions that I was a biologist for years. I have never even thought about or ever thought to ask.
Yeah, I mean, all that I got with the armpit hair is like it can trap scent more. And yeah, I just, you're like, that doesn't sound good.
No, and also I feel like if I were super like bushy under my arms, I would smell worse, but
yeah,
maybe not.
No, yeah, you smell worse.
Oh,
well,
okay.
Like it smells more.
Yeah.
More then fragrant.
All the sweat is in the hair.
But how we interpret smell depends also a lot on culture.
Yeah.
Which I also learned when I did the vaginal scent chapter. But the other crazy thing about armpit hair was when you're not used to having it, like I would kind of like point at something and I'd be like, what is that? It would be like, I would think like a rodent went by, but it was just my armpit.
Oh my God, that's fucking hilarious. So wait, you're right. But, like when you talk about culture, because even in modern, you know, Western society, we all have friends and family or have traveled the world and gone to some Eastern cultures where people don't like wear deodorant the way that we do. And there's like a BO smell when you're in like crowded places, like markets, you know, street markets, taxi cabs, things like that. And we're like appalled by it. But obviously, if they were, they would do something about it. It's just part of the culture.
Yeah. I talked to this woman, Rachel Hurst from Brown, and she's written a lot on olfactory scents. And she told me stuff that like I just couldn't even really believe. It was so hard to wrap my head around. It was during the chapter about vaginal scent and why we've come to like believe there's this fish connotation, or so many women believe they smell bad when it's really just a very natural needed scent, because it's the scent that the bacteria give off and the bacteria are protecting us. So it's like, that's needed. That's great. And then like, unless you have like a bacterial vaginosis infection, but that's another thing.
Yeah. And you can sometimes tell through the scent or through the discharge or something like that.
Oh yeah. The test that a GYN, a gyno, will give you is called the whiff test to find out if you have bacterial vaginosis. So
what a life.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, really? They haven't gone farther than that? Like, they still have to sniff it? They mix it with a chemical. I'm forgetting right now what it is. But if it has a very fishy odor when they do that, they have bacterial vaginosis.
So there you go. It's fishy when you have an infection, not in everyday life.
Right. But so this Rachel Herz was saying that we're born with a blank slate as to how we feel about smells. And then we learn it through experience and through being taught. So I was like, but vomit is clearly like gross. And she's like, no, like you're taught not to like vomit. And then get this, I have twins a year ago. They get car sick a lot. And because I've just been like, I don't think, is it possible? And then the little boy, I see him in the back mirror and this is going to be gross. He eats it. Like if it's still like got little chunks of banana, it comes out and he's like, great, a snack.
And dogs do that all the time. Like other, you know, species do that. It does not turn them off in the least.
Yeah. So I've got to teach him about vomit. And the other thing she said is like, if we've been taught or it's in the culture that our vaginas smell bad, we can believe it smells bad without even having ever smelled it. Or like we interpret it as bad or like attached to the fish scent when we do smell it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like pretty nuts.
It is weird, too, because there's a lot of research that shows, I think, that, like, people's own, you know, shit or farts or whatever, like, doesn't offend them as much as other people. So there is some weird kind of stuff going on with how we've been socialized. And I can imagine that even as an infant, when mom or dad is changing your diaper and is going like, ugh. Oh, yeah. Look at what you did, that you're going to internalize a lot of weird stuff and you're going to start kind of projecting that on other people.
Yeah. And I guess there's also a reason for some of it. Like we don't want, you know, babies are like, oh, cool, poop. I'm going to play with that. That's all nice and mushy. And you don't want babies to be eating poop.
Yeah.
So it's important in some ways to tell them not to eat their poop.
It is an important lesson, an important lesson from your book.
I didn't realize like, for some reason, they really are attracted to bird poop, my twins. And I was on a panel with Rob Knight, like one of the preeminent like researchers on the microbiome. And he's like, dirt is good. You know, you got to introduce to the micro. And I was like, what about bird poop? And he's like, oh, no. You cannot have them eat bird poop. That is absolutely not. This is after he's like, yeah, get them on the ground. They can eat sand, you know, everything. The one thing.
No bird poop.
He's like, are they shitting blood? I was like, no. Jesus, he's like, okay, they're okay.
Oh, my God. Oh, shit. I have to admit that there's something in me that is fascinated by blood and guts and puke and shit and like weird, like what I shouldn't even say weird, right? Because I'm already like using those societal judgments, but like things that we think of as super gross. Like one of the most interesting things to me in the world is tonsil stones. They're so disgusting and amazing, and I'm fascinated by them. I even have a friend named Anna Rothschild. She's at the Washington Post now. I'm actually going to have her on the show, I think, in a few months. But her old YouTube channel was Gross Science, and it was all just gross. It's like more geared towards kids, but totally interesting for adults. And it's all just like burps and farts and weird shit like that. And like, I love that. I mean, I eat that stuff up, and it seems like, maybe I'm wrong, you have this kind of intrinsic, I don't know, curiosity about these things as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm very curious about how the body works, but it's also like this book is, I think, specific to shame as well. Like the things that have rub in our lives, mostly as women, some are also very relatable to men, but things where like with the beard hair or the chin hair, the goatee, where I just felt, okay, this is natural. It's happening to my body.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I feel so shitty about it? and trying to kind of figure out why, put it in the context of how did this happen? What does it do for my body? Is it normal? And then go from there.
Yeah, in a way, like, how can we also be empowered to kind of, like, it's hard, right, to push past the way that we've been socialized from the time we were infants to not feel shitty about ourselves every day, because that's not psychologically healthy.
Yeah, and I think I was going to mention about, like, did I change? When I grew up my hair, I didn't feel good about it. Like, I didn't feel like I didn't feel empowered. I didn't feel liberated. I wasn't like, whoa, this is the full expression of my natural form. I just felt like a little bit like outside the lines, because I guess when you've been in a culture like this, like, you really internalize it all. Mm. So what changed for me was I still do what I did and I do what makes me feel good, but I don't have the anxiety behind it and the hiding feeling, which really changes it completely, you know? So, and I felt like, okay, to be embracing of your parts does not necessarily mean that you have to, like, not wear makeup or not do what makes you feel good. You do what makes you feel good, but hopefully it's from a place of, like, wanting rather than fear. And I think before we can be that full natural form, the culture has to change to have a wider idea of what's beautiful.
For sure. And I think every woman out there probably has this experience of picking and choosing what she is more comfortable or confident rejecting or embracing. Like, I don't wear makeup on a daily basis, mainly because I'm, like, incredibly lazy. And it's just, I look at my girlfriends who spend an hour every morning getting ready, and I'm like, how do you afford that time? Yeah. Like, I roll out of bed and go to my first meeting. I can't afford that kind of time. But when I'm on television, of course, I do full hair and makeup. Or I like to keep my nails done, though. It's actually, you're looking at, it's quite rare right now that I took off my powder manicure, and I've got, like, natural nails right now. That's super rare. But I also have had laser done on my legs, my underarms, and my bikini line, mostly because it's so liberating to just not have to shave, but I still get the joy of not having, like, bushy legs.
Yeah, it's like everyone has their own definition of how they want to look, or it's like being authentic to how you feel. And yeah, I think that's great. And I'm the same way. And I don't wear makeup mostly because I don't know how to put makeup on. I never, like, learned. I'm like, oh, I wonder how I'd look if I did that.
Maybe. Have you had your makeup done before?
I have had it, and I always feel like I look really funny just because I'm not used to seeing myself that way. So, but maybe I look better. I don't know.
Did you wear makeup at your wedding?
I wore a tiny bit. They put it on and then I freaked out, and then they had to, like, take most of it off.
So just enough to kind of feel like you were...
It was a special day.
Yeah. That's cool. I actually really appreciate that. I like that. My biggest concern, and maybe I shouldn't even have this concern because maybe this is my own form of being judgmental, but my biggest concern is for women who feel so uncomfortable in their own skin that they don't have any sources of that authenticity. You know, they feel the need to wear makeup and heels and dress to the nines and do their hair every day and make sure they're... So there's not a single part of them that hasn't been manipulated in an effort to exude some sort of vision that they have for themselves. And I don't even know if psychologically that's all that damaging. I just bemoan the waste of time. Like, there's so many other things we could be doing with our time. But, you know, I also feel like to each their own.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel the same way about time, about us being mean to ourselves, the repetitive thinking that women and probably men, just people, have about being down on themselves, whether it be weight or hair or whatever. And what I didn't like about what was happening to me, about the fear about being found out, that my focus wasn't on living and being present and talking to my partner. It was on, like, fear and anxiety and am I good enough? And, like, all these amazing, talented friends I have that I see go through the same kind of rut of thinking. And I'm kind of like, wow, if you can fix it by, if you make yourself feel better by these practices you do, then that's something.
Yeah.
And also, like, again, it can come from different places. Is it fear of not fitting in, or is it like, oh, this is my best self? And yes, culture has taught us that that's what our best selves look like. But
yeah, because we can take it back. We can iterate it to a place where it makes sense for everybody, right? So you might be listening to this right now. Maybe you're a woman, maybe you're a man listening to this, and you love wearing makeup and you can't imagine facing the world without makeup. that to me is so far away from my understanding, but there are plenty of people who feel that way. But I could iterate it back and say like, well, I can't imagine leaving my house without brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and like it, because it's like personal for me, I feel better about myself.
And for a lot of people, I think makeup is a creative expression. Mm-hmm. So they're, it's art and they're making themselves into like an individual that way. Just like someone would dye their hair a certain color.
Or like tattoos and piercings.
Or even wear a certain kind of clothing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm an athletic person, I wear this, or I'm, you know, it's the same thing in some ways.
Do you feel like when you set out, like when you first started writing the essays and then you decided, okay, I'm going to put these things together and I'm going to write a fully formed book, did you already have that conclusion in your mind? This idea of all these things that we think of that are super gross are, I think, culturally disempowering to women. And if we learn about ourselves and embrace ourselves and then cope with those things or have a relationship with those things in whatever way we want personally, we'll feel good in our own skin. Like, did you even know that was where you were going?
No, not really.
So you were just feeling really shit about yourself when you first wrote these things.
I mean, I wouldn't say that.
It's somewhere in between.
It's like it was a fascination. I've always really liked writing from a personal place. And especially the things that I struggle with are things that like I kind of talk like give me rub, like there's some sort of rub with it. So like it felt like a mystery kind of. It was like, why do I feel weird about my vaginal odor? Why like is when a dog comes and beelines for my crotch, am I like, is this okay? Like, you know, I'm like, my dog loves garbage and feces and dead rodents and my crotch. What's happening? You know,
but he also loves kisses.
Yeah.
And babies.
Yeah, but not in the same way. But just those things of like curiosity. Why is this happening? And also just like intimacy with my partner, like, you know, always feeling a little bit on edge if he's there going, does it smell okay? What is he thinking?
When did I shower last? Like, is today okay?
And like kind of needing a reinforcement. I'm like, hey, babe.
Yeah.
Babe. Thumbs up. Is it okay?
And I've met girls before who have told me like they won't let guys go down and they don't want to have that kind of relationship because they're too self-conscious.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, what an amazing thing to be missing out on in your life.
Yeah. So it was really came from there. Just like, why?
I have to say that it gives me great joy to hear you talk about your journey in that way, because, you know, on the show, we often talk about science and science communication, which is a growing kind of burgeoning field of many sort of trained scientists, but also trained journalists who have decided and realized that we have a real problem with science literacy and science denialism. Sometimes the scientists don't always do the best job of translating for, you know, everyday people who don't have a science background. But sometimes I feel like the piece that's missing, and even sometimes from myself, which makes me feel really horrible about some of my efforts in this field, is that like approaching it purely through curiosity. And I feel like the best science communicators out there are people like you who maybe, you know, aren't even coming at it from this like heavy science perspective, but you're like, I don't understand this, or I want to understand it more. I'm just going to go ask people.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. It's like such a beautiful thing that I feel like I wish more people did, but at least we have books like yours to be able to live vicariously through. And by the way, you're so fucking funny.
Oh, thanks.
Can you tell me a little bit? Because of course, everything that I'm reading talks about the beginnings with the Bearded Lady, Kindle book, but like, where did you know, what made you first want to start writing? What is your background? Like, where did you come to these approaches to creativity and to sharing your story?
Yeah. I just had to say something real quick, since it is science show, mm-hmm. is that I'm so grateful to the scientists who take their time to talk. It's amazing. These people who are so knowledgeable, have written all these amazing papers, and I email them, and I just like hope that they'll be open to it. And so many people are. It's so cool.
That's awesome. It's so good to hear, too, because there is a sect within science, generally older, I don't want to be ageist, but generally much older, who feel like they shouldn't promote their own work and just read the journal articles and I'm too busy and I'm too caught up in my lab work. But I do see this really beautiful growing trend of scientists being like, Yeah, I want people to know this stuff. Yeah. And the best way to know it is to talk to somebody like you who can write about it beautifully. And this is your path, you know, like you can share this with people in a way that is completely accessible, is entertaining, is fulfilling, and help fill that gap in between this esoteric knowledge that's living in these journals that are behind payrolls that nobody or paywalls that nobody can read. And of course, having a conversation like we're having right now on the podcast. So that's so good to hear that there were so many people who were
so nice,
were open
so
with amazing. Their time. Yeah. And was it mostly phone calls, emails? Like, how did you do your reporting?
Mostly phone calls. I'd like record the phone call, transcribe, do the whole thing. Yeah, I wish they could have been more in person, actually, but there was just such a spread, you know?
And it's so expensive to do that. Like, I don't think people realize with how publishing is right now. Like, those advances do not cover that many plane tickets.
No. And I mean, it worked really well because, like, people are really busy too. And there's really, and in some ways, there's no need. But there, when I felt like I did something interactive, I would go to the place and do it. But amazing people.
Really, I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have a book if people didn't want to share their information. So
it's so great. And so, you know, you have this curiosity, you have this interest, you decide to write about it. But before that, there must have been something that made you say, like, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
Or I'm funny.
I didn't start writing until college. Mm-hmm. Like, I took a writing class and I got a little bit of good feedback and it went a long way. I was like, oh, maybe I'm a writer. and I at that time, I didn't really see the difference between being a writer and a journalist. So I thought to be a writer, I could maybe be a journalist. But then I now see them having experienced both as very different things. You have to have something to say to be a writer. Like, you can write something really beautiful, but if it's not about a thing, it kind of fizzles.
Yeah.
So I kind of realized that when I was a journalist for a year in Thailand, in Bangkok, and I was realizing that, like, I could write well, but I didn't really know what to say yet in my life. I don't know. That's kind of sidetracked.
But that makes sense. I mean, I think a lot of journalists start out in straight journalism with assignments. You know, that used to be how it was. You worked a desk and then you had an assignment and you would do it. And now that the freelance lifestyle has grown so much and there's so few people that are on staff, you're pitching, mm-hmm. which means you have to come up with the story.
Yeah.
And that's a totally different skill set.
Yeah. So I was interested in writing, went to Thailand. Well, no, first I'm like, wait, I went to right after college, I went to India. I got a gig as a writer at a local English version paper of a Canada paper. So, like, in Karnataka. Did that make sense?
It made sense. You were
I'm like, wait, cut that out.
Canadian English in India.
No, it was like Canada is the language of Karnataka state.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So there were opportunities.
But so there was like this little kind of paper that was in English for, you know, whatever.
Nice. And so, wait, I have to ask, like, why'd you go to India? Just because you really wanted to experience
it? Yeah, I did. My parents went there at some point when I was in, like, junior high, and they came back with all these stories, and I was like, I have to go there. And I really loved it. It was amazing. And I really liked the paper life. I applied to journalism school, and I got in to Columbia. I went there, and I think still kind of confused between, like, do I want to be a writer or a journalist, or what's the difference?
And so is J school, like, was that undergrad?
That was
grad school. So you had already gone to college.
Yeah. So after college was India. And then once I had that experience, I was like, yeah, I want to go, like, be more serious with this.
What did you study in college?
Communications, mass communications. I went to UCLA.
Cool. So you're local at the time.
Yeah. Yes.
Were you born here?
I was born in San Diego.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're SoCal, born and raised.
Yeah. And then I was in New York for 13 years and just came back.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So then I went to J school, got a paper job in Bangkok for a year. And then.
And that was, so you went there for work?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, Thailand, whatever.
Yeah.
That's so cool when I meet people who are like, yeah, I'll just go live in a totally different culture for a year where I don't speak the language and don't know anybody.
It was pretty intense. Like, try to figure out how to report from people who did not speak English. Yeah. It was like, you know, I would be going in the taxi and I would try and, like, tell them that I wanted to go to the hospital to talk to like a doctor or something. And I'd be like trying to do signals like, you know, like one time I got so frustrated, like I showed up at the place like crying and they all, and then of course they met me on the curb. So I didn't even have time to like wipe my tears and they just bring me into the office and they start giving me like teas. Like, are you okay? That's just not how you want to show up as a professional. You know,
that's so sweet. It was so good to know they embraced you with open arms.
Yeah. I was like 24. It was very sweet, but not my highlight moment. Yeah, there for a year. And then I spent like 3 months at the Olive Garden in between jobs.
bartending or waiting tables?
I was waiting tables.
Nice. So you wore the fabulous tie every day?
Yeah.
I have to. I mean, I think I've admitted this on the show before, but Olive Garden is like my legit guilty pleasure.
Is it?
I am obsessed with Olive Garden because I grew up in the burbs in Texas. Like I was in the suburbs of Dallas. And, you know, a lot of people have this experience where the Olive Garden is like the nicest restaurant
it's
in
like
their town.
Big night out.
Yeah. That's like where you go for your birthday and
all
stuff.
All you can eat breadsticks. Yeah.
And so living in LA where it's mostly boutique-y, you know, really, really delicious. Like we're very lucky with our foodie culture here. But there are times when you just crave something that tastes the exact same every time you eat it. And that brings you back to this nostalgic place. So yes, for my birthday a couple years ago, I legit had it catered.
That's awesome. Oh, that's so fun. That's
after
great.
My own heart that you chose to work.
Yeah.
There.
It was interesting. I had someone leave me like a therapist card. He's like, if you need to see a therapist. So I was like, what does that mean?
Was he the therapist?
Yeah, I think so.
That's
like, I think, well, yeah, I don't know.
It's a strange thing.
Like, I had just come back from, you know, Thailand for a year. So I don't know. I might have sat in this. I don't know. Who knows? I may have told him too much.
It's some eye contact issues or something.
Yes. It was a weird year. It was a really weird year.
And so that was like, I just need a job. I need to pay my rent while I figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
I love, though, that you have that because I meet a lot of young people now and I don't know if it's right to assume, but I assume that you and I are similar in age. I'm in my mid-30s.
Yeah.
And so I meet a lot of young people, you know, my age or younger now, who kind of have this very, like, heavy line in the sand of, like, ugh, that's beneath me, or I would never do that kind of work. Yet they don't mind living at home with their parents or, you know, literally having 17 roommates in, like, the shittiest, most disgusting apartment. But they would refuse to work for the man at Olive Garden.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was cool. It was, like, such a good learning experience.
Hell
it,
yeah.
Yeah, it was nice.
Will you ever eat Olive Garden again?
I would probably eat Olive Garden, but I also worked at Subway, and I probably would not eat Subway.
Oh, shit. Good to know.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the smell of it brings up a lot.
Yeah.
It just, why does it always smell the same and not like food? I don't know.
You're right. It does have a very strange fake bread smell when you walk in. Like, I mean, rubber and bread.
They start in, like, these sticks that are frozen, and then they kind of grow as you put them in the bread incubator. So I don't know what's happening either.
So I had this experience when I was, I want to say I was 16, 17. I worked at what we colloquially called Feces Pizza, which is actually CeCe's Pizza. And it's funny because I actually liked it. I don't know why we all called it Feces Pizza. But the problem when you work in food service like this, my biggest problem when I worked at CeCe's was that my clothes always smelled like pizza grease.
Yeah.
Even if you wash them with like bleach, it doesn't matter. And that's why I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but I knew somebody once who worked at In-N-Out and they were saying that, you know, they really take care of them. The pay is really good. The healthcare, the benefits are good. And one of the things that they do for their workers, I don't know if it's still the case, is that they provide them with their clean uniforms and they change at work. So they can leave the clothes that smell like burgers and fries behind, and they don't have to take that smell home with them.
That's really nice.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Because that is like something that turns you off.
Yeah.
You can't do it anymore. It's just, ugh,
even
Subway.
If you hang out at Starbucks for like an hour, you are infused with Starbucks smell.
Completely. Which isn't the worst smell in the world.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Subway might be worse. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
But, just to like be quick with it, I then worked at the Village Voice for almost a year. I got a job there after Olive Garden as a staff writer.
In New York?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was in San Diego working, and then I went and moved to New York, and that's when I made my move. And then there was like this big shakeup, and I got fired for taste. And I was like, what does that mean?
What does that mean?
I think it means they don't like me.
For taste?
Yeah. Huh. I mean, it was a union, so it's like one of the things you could use to fire somebody.
Like your voice didn't fit in with what they were looking for, some bullshit.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, it was all good. It was an exciting time.
But also, you know what? It's good to get fired at least once.
Oh, yeah.
Not everybody's been fired.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like when you first, like high-achieving students first go to a competitive university or a graduate school and they make a failing grade for the first time. Like, if you never have that feeling, then you never know what it means to kind of pick yourself back up or what it means to learn from those mistakes. And I think that it can be an incredibly important, not just growth experience, but like humbling experience.
Yeah. Something to build on with the next failed moment.
Totally. When they just, you just start collecting them in life.
You know, it was huge for me. When I was at the Village Voice, I got targeted by Gawker. Do you know that website? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I got like pretty reamed by them like over and over again over like a period of months.
What were you writing about?
It was not, I don't know why they targeted me necessarily. It was just like they made fun of a lot of people and I was one of them.
That was kind of Gawker's MO, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Like at the time it wasn't like celebrities. It was like just random like people trying to write things.
It's so horrible. So, like, this person looks like they're first
trying hard.
Yeah. Struggling a little.
But that was incredibly like informative for me. Like, I think at the time it was, I had viewed writing as either people like it or they don't, you know, and you're one or the other. But in that I had to learn that like a lot of people won't like it and some people really love it and it exists at the same, it's the same thing, but it'll hit someone different. And I had to learn that to keep going forward, you know, that all these people could hate on me, but whatever, you know, other people it spoke to.
And that's so important too, because I think that psychologically we do have a tendency to notice the negative responses and make them bigger than they are. And then the positive, it's like, oh yeah, love it, whatever, whatever, whatever. And then it's like, this is a flaming pile of gold. Nobody loves my work. Yeah. But the truth is, you're right. Like, especially in a world now where everybody, not everybody, most people have a social media presence. Most people have like a personal brand, regardless of what they do for a living. They have an icon and, you know, a bio, and they get feedback for the 140 character thoughts that they put out into the universe, or an image. You know, I'm an amateur photographer and I post my photography. And then people say and do shitty things and we internalize it so much. But we never stop to think that people who are idolized, like let's say Queen Beyonce.
Yeah.
The amount of hate that she probably gets is irrational.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, nobody can find fault with her, yet she still gets so much hate.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, mostly it just built like the thick skin, you know, and I was so lucky to have that really early on, like lucky in a weird way. But yeah,
it's important.
I think so now. It takes a lot. I mean, I just wrote a New York Times article about my dog, about how my dog was kind of like a starter kid and that we like kind of ruined her because we didn't train her well, because she just broke us down at every turn. We were like, okay, you don't have to be in your crate. Okay, you don't have to do that. Okay. Okay, you could just be you. You know, oh yeah, poop on, you know. She started pooping in our bathtub and we were like, that's not cool, Chucho. You shouldn't poop in our tub, you know? And then we were kind of like, after the third time, we're all, Chucho's a freaking genius. She wants to poop on porcelain just like us. She sees that. And so we just started like letting her, but we put potty pads and everything. But then we had twins. And we were like, oh my God, we did that completely wrong. Like, we're going to go 180. The babies are going to be nothing like Chucho. And we've done a great job. But you put that out on the internet. And I thought, like, puppies and babies, like, who's going to not like that? And like, it turns out like a lot of people don't, like, they're upset with how I trained my dog. Like, very mad. Very, very upset. And
and I hear all the time from young, like, feminist writers or mother writers. Like, I had Angela Garbez on the show talking about, you know, her trials and tribulations through pregnancy. And just like, everybody wants to tell you how to raise your kid. Like, even people who don't have kids, even, and I guess that extends to dogs too.
Yeah.
Like, everyone has some advice for you that was not solicited.
Yeah. It's all good though. Like, it's at least engaged.
Yeah.
People like feel something. That's cool.
Look at you. Silver lining. Do you ever feel like, though, you have to make that decision to just not read comments or not go on the internet on certain days for your own mental health?
I haven't Googled myself, I think, since 2000 and probably 7.
But you have a book out.
I know. I just don't.
Holy shit. So do you just wait until the publicist from the publishing house like sends you coverage on
your
book?
And I don't read it. Yeah. I let other people read it and they can tell me if they want to.
Smart.
Yeah.
Like on it, the book is done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What can I do?
Yeah.
I'm really happy that people are writing about it and have a lot of thoughts about it. It's really great. And I think most of it has been good, but I just don't really want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can't avoid it. Like right after you leave here today, you're going to go and do a reading at Skylight Books, which is really close to me.
Yeah.
It's here in Los Feliz. And then the people are there and they can just say whatever they want to say to your face. I assume most people, when they're face to face, have some amount of like decorum, though.
Yeah, I've had great readings so far. It's been really fun. A lot of laughter. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so did you expect it to be like that, writing this book?
That it would... people? Like,
well, just, you know, I don't know if most writers who are writing all the time and then they take on a book, which is a totally different platform than journalism or even than like editorial kind of feature op-eds. You have to travel all around and you go to all these events and you try to sell books and you kind of like are putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
Did you, it's like in your head, you know what is coming, but has it been the same as you expected it to be?
No, I mean, I had a book before this, Thanks for Coming, and it was a very different release. It was more like chill.
Mm-hmm.
This one, they've put a lot into it. They're like, I'm on tour for like a week and a half. Every day I've been reading and going to events and interviews, and it's freaking awesome. Like, it's so exhausting. But my mom is on tour with me, and she's been so funny and just supportive. I'm like, thanks, Mom. You know,
it's amazing.
Yeah. I've been like, I have so many emotions. I feel like a toddler. I'm like high and low, and I'm trying not to I do look at Amazon rankings, and that's just a terrible thing to do because you could just feel like crap in a second. And nothing would probably be good enough because you're like, well, why am I not that? Why am I not that?
Yeah.
But just the fact that, like, I get an email where someone's like, I feel so much better about myself after reading that. I'm like, whoa, that's so amazing. It's the best.
Especially since this was a journey that you undertook for yourself, really. You were like, I'm curious about my own body and about why I feel kind of shitty about certain things and why other things don't bother me. And I'm just going to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then so many people see themselves in that experience because it really is kind of universal, especially for women, isn't it?
It seems to be, yeah. And there are things that I just had to trust that other people feel the same way. I mean, we're all in a way a product of our culture. And so I'm not like having these original thoughts, you know?
Do you think that a lot of this comes from this sort of like youth obsessed culture, this sort of, I don't know, pedomorphism or this neoteny that we're so interested in like being a perfect angelic young version of ourselves?
I think some of it is. And I think probably fear of mortality in some ways too. But I think it comes, I mean, it really depends on, because I'm not an expert and I talk to experts, each expert seems to have their own opinion of why, and they never seem to fully match up. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
It's really hard to know where it all comes from.
I'm glad you mentioned the fear of mortality because that's something I've been putting a lot of my effort into lately. You know, I've been working as a science communicator for the last 10 years, but I've decided to go back to school. I have a master's, but I wanted to do the PhD, finish. I did a year and I dropped out. So yeah, I'm now at a year into my new PhD. In
UCLA
No, I'm actually at a school called Fielding, which is in Santa Barbara,
okay.
But it's the only APA accredited psychology, clinical psych school in the country where the vast majority of your coursework is remote. So I can still work.
That's great.
It's amazing. But I'm realizing I'm really narrowing in on my research interests and my clinical interests, and they really are coming to this place of working with people who are dying and understanding the American relationship with death. And I think there's a lot of crossover. The American relationship with how we see ourselves as, I don't know, carriers of beauty or carriers of intellect or whatever, but also the American relationship with mortality and death. It's just, we're a very death-denying, youth-obsessed, afraid of imperfection culture, like anything that has to do with like rot or decay or breaking down or like smells or these interesting sides. We're super scared of them societally.
Yeah. I talked to this woman, Jamie Goldenberg, about in the sweat chapter, and she believes in this theory, like terror management theory. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. Ernest Becker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she's like a student of his thought, basically. And you know, we're all gods with anuses. That's his famous quote. And she just said that she really thinks that's why we're so freaked out about our sweat stains and our, you know, what we smell like. All of those things that are animal-like, beast-like, remind us of our mortality. And so we cover them up and we're, you know, very repulsed by them.
Yeah. And we live in this society now where not only do we have all of these technological things. I mean, low tech versus high tech. We've got makeup and we've got deodorizers and we've got perfumes and all, you know, those things have been around forever. But we're also in a culture where there are people who actively think that if they like freeze their bodies, they're going to come back to life, or who are doing all these high tech things to literally avoid death. And so it's hard to get through to people sometimes, like, no, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to happen. And that's what I'm super interested in studying is how do we help, as therapists, help people understand that this is normal and it's not something to be afraid of, or at least if we are going to be afraid of it, that we should approach it with kind of an open understanding of it.
That's so cool.
To help protect ourselves, right? Or prepare ourselves.
How do you think you are on that spectrum?
Yeah, it's interesting because I do think I have this semi-standard line with this, that I don't think I'm that afraid of death, like the concept of death. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in the afterlife. I don't think anything, like, I don't think I'm going to be judged. I think that after I die, I'm going to be worm food. And because I don't believe in any sort of sustaining consciousness, like the lights are out, I'm not going to know any different. The main thing is there are different reasons different people are afraid of death. And mine is like the pain aspect. Like, I'm afraid of the pain, but I'm comforted by the fact that we have so many great options with palliative care and with hospice to try and reduce the physical pain. The psychological pain is something that I personally think we should embrace a little more, that there's stuff that comes from suffering.
Tell me more.
Positive things that come out of suffering. And I think that there's so many parallels with what you're talking about here. Like, sometimes looking at the chin hair and just seeing it in the mirror before we pluck it, or like seeing ourselves the way that we are in our raw form, helps us be more, like, have a feeling of being more authentic. And it doesn't mean we have to live our lives like that all the time.
Yeah.
Right? That's like Heidegger used to talk about this idea that there's like this two modes of being. There's the ontological mode where you're like actively aware of, acutely aware of your own death, and acutely aware of being kind of like you are when you're on acid and it's like really intense. And then there's the like everyday mode where we're a little in denial about it. And you got to have both, right? Because if you're constantly thinking about authenticity, like, you're crippled by it. But I do think touching it, dipping your toe in it, brings you to like a heightened, I don't know,
state of being, like a more awareness of living.
Like, do you feel kind of more, I don't know, it's such a wooey word, but like more actualized or more kind of complete or more in touch with yourself after going through this journey and learning all of these things about your body?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's really, I learned so much, and I feel like there's a ton more to learn. But yeah, and I just am like super fascinated by what you're learning, and I want to hear more about that. I do. Yeah,
we got to dive in together. Maybe we can co-write a book sometime.
Yeah.
Really fun. What is the grossest thing that you discovered as you were reading and learning that you still think is super gross and you can't get past?
Like, you know, gross is with quotation marks. So nothing was like, you know, in that way, I guess, gross. I think there was more gross things that I like just was so excited about. Like little facts. The sex sound chapter is one of my favorite chapters because it's kind of the way I got into that is that I consider myself a sex mute. I don't make much sound during sex. And I always felt like, well, maybe if the right, like if it was the right sex or if I felt the right way, the sounds would come. Or,
and do you mean vocalizations?
Yeah, yes.
You don't mean like the macaroni and cheese sound, like the
actual physical sounds. That would be great if that was like mute. No. No, I'm like, just press a button. Mute. No, I mean like the hollering and the loud noises and the moany, like erotic sounds.
Doesn't that all come from porn?
Well, that's what I wanted to know. Yeah. Like, does it come from porn or is it part of our human behavior, or like, does it add to pleasure? Is there something that when you're a sex mute or a silent fucker, whichever way you want to describe it.
Yeah. Are you not enjoying it as much?
Yeah. Or am I not getting something if, you know, that, and so I was like, at the beginning, it's kind of like, you know, I want to be this person who, like, when someone goes by their bedroom window outside, they're like, oh my God, is she like having the best sex ever? Or is she getting murdered? I don't know. That's hot. I don't know.
Have you tried it?
To make the sounds?
Yeah.
Well, that's like cliffhanger material. Yeah, but sure. But no, one of my favorite things was talking to this grunt expert. I know, right? Lorraine McCune from Rutgers, who studies the grunt. She studies it about how it's like the beginning, the origin of language is the grunt. Kids start referring to objects with a grunt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a physiological response to exertion. So it's the sound that's made when you get up out of a chair, or it's that sound that Hollywood makes when they want to make you think there's sex, but then you open the door and someone's like jump roping, or they're trying to get something out of the bottom of the bed or whatever.
Yes. And even people who are deaf who never developed language skills make these vocalizations.
Yeah. So, in my thinking, like, that's also the sex grunt, but the it's like there's so many different things coming up in my head right now. But there was also this study that I read about yellow baboons, that they were making the same sexual copulation vocalizations when they were taking a dump. So they were like having orgasmic sounds when they were shitting. And so that's that grunt. Like, we also grunt when we go to the bathroom.
You're right. And some people would claim that shitting is like secondary sex, like the way it feels.
Yeah. And then I talked to this neuroscientist, Barry Komisarek, because Lorraine McCune was like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to, like, I deal with language and children, and I'm not going to comment on sex with my grunt, you know, which I respected completely. Yeah. But also she did say that, like, the grunt can add more force, just like a tennis player like grunting actually does add force to the ball.
So it's like the Valsalva maneuver, like when you bear down, if you like, you could push a little more air out.
Yeah. So then I'm like, okay, well, are you adding force to your hump when you grunt?
Mm.
And that might be. But so Barry, are you following? There's a lot happening.
I am. And you can see the wheels turning in my head.
So then Barry, I was like, Barry, okay, like, we've got the grunt here, and like, but what does it mean? Like, is that what we're doing when we're having sex? Is it just like the grunt? Is that the origin? And he says, it's like seagulls. And I'm like, okay, tell me more. He's like, you know, they're all sitting on a pier, and then one takes off and it goes, ah, ah, ah. And so that's the sound that their body makes. It's like their grunt, you know, it's a physiological response to exertion. But the seagulls around them come to understand that sound that's made naturally signifies something else. It signifies that the bird has taken off.
Mm-hmm.
So they all take off as it's a communication. And then the same thing can happen with sex. It's like it begins as a grunt, but we like accentuate it and it comes to mean more and it becomes a communication, which is really kind of a cool way to think about it.
And so you can almost imagine that there are like, have you ever, as a sort of silent sexer, a silent fucker, had a partner who was like insanely loud and felt like super out of sync?
Oh yeah.
And so it's interesting that maybe if you had continued that sexual journey for years and years and years on end, maybe you would have gotten louder. They would have gotten quieter because of that, you know, that, I don't know, play back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, definitely it could. I've tried to make more sound and see what it's like. But then there's also like evolutionary theorists and sexologists who have a different like kind of theory that it comes because we're like the baboons make really loud sounds and they think it's because they're attracting other mates with the sounds actually, but other theorists don't believe that. They think
kind of like, I'm amazing at this. Next time you're going to want to do it with me.
Yeah, kind of like that. Or the female makes the loud sounds to attract the males.
Yeah.
So that if, you know, it's like to prevent patricide or not patricide, but like the killing of the young, because they'll all be kind of confused of whose baby it is.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad we don't have to deal with that as much.
I know. Wouldn't that be so, like, stressful?
Rough. So rough.
So I was kind of like to my husband, I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't make noises to try and attract, like, our next door neighbor. You should. A good thing.
Totally. Yes. Keeping it locked down in the home. That's hilarious.
Well, okay. That went deep, but what I really wanted to talk about was how the poop grunt and the sex grunt they're very related.
I love that. And so, but you're like a young mom now. And so I think the stereotype.
I think I'm an old mom.
No, you're a young mom.
I think the current idea of what.
You're right. Oh my God, it's so shift. Like, you're right. In our parents' generation.
I would be like ancient mom.
Yeah. But I'm like, oh, you're a young hot mom. You are. And so, you know, I think the stereotype is that moms or women in general, like, aren't really grossed out by puke and shit and stuff. Like, we evolved to be able to deal with it better. And sometimes dudes are like, ugh, I don't want to get near it. Even though that stereotype, like, definitely doesn't hold with everybody. Is there anything, though, as you were exploring your own body, as you think about it in relationship to, like, your children's bodies or to other people's bodies, let's say you worked in a hospital or something like that, where there is something, some sort of quote-unquote gross thing, where you just physiologically respond to it in a way that no matter how much you think about it, how much you understand it, you're like, bleh, bleh.
Well, probably when you do that, like, it makes me think about puke. Mm-hmm. Puke really makes me pukey.
It does. Because for some people, puke makes them puke.
Yeah, puke makes me puke. But I didn't research the puke. Mm-hmm. That maybe that's for the next
you compilation. Do a whole book about puke.
I mean, saliva kind of grosses me out too, but it's contextually related.
Is it like kissing?
Like, if there was like a person that had like a mouthful of saliva and I kissed them and it just like came down like a glass of water, that would be horrifying to me.
I get it. That's disgusting. I can't watch when people are like making out on TV and it's like.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, that's one of the grossest things to me.
It's not good.
No.
But like babies, like having two babies that are teething at the same time and dripping saliva, also not great.
Interesting. So that doesn't bother me at all. Like clear baby spit just all over their faces and like all over my chest.
Just.
Don't care. And I don't even have kids.
Yeah. I'm like, let me get that for you.
Yeah. And baby puke doesn't grow. Like milk puke.
Oh, yeah. That's fine for me.
That doesn't gross me.
It's when it starts to have that sour.
Smell. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I don't like buffalo wings. I think that they smell like vomit.
Wow.
Have you? And other people don't get that when I
For
say
me,
that.
For me, blue cheese stuffed green olives, like exact vomit flavor.
Interesting. Oh, the flavor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ew.
I did that once and I was like, never.
Why do people want to eat things that taste and smell like vomit?
Apparently it doesn't do that to the same, like we're having different experiences because I like wings. They don't remind me of vomit.
Really? That acidic kind of sour?
It's good.
It's good.
It's good. I like it.
Oh my God. Mara, I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but I have to let you go to your reading. It's 4:05. Your reading's at what, 4:45?
Is that five?
It's a five. Okay, cool. Yeah. So we can wind down. Yeah. I can ask you my closing question.
Yeah,
today.
Ask
okay,
me.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, so. I have to get there early because we're doing a screening of our trailers.
Yes, it's so exciting. Oh, wait. First, let's talk about that before I ask you the final two questions.
Okay.
The trailer for what? Tell me everything.
I made four trailers with my best friend since we were five. She's an actress. She's like been on Broadway and I'm so proud of her. But
what's her name?
Chandra Lee Schwartz, but Breslow now. But,
awesome.
Yeah. And she executive produced them and we like went so hardcore. They're like little shorts, like sketches. And there's one about camel toes, one about vag scent, one about sweat, and one about pimple picking. And
yes.
Yeah, oh God, I'm so proud of them.
Yes.
So please check them out.
So wait, where can people see them?
Hopefully by the time this comes out, mm-hmm. they'll be on my website under other stuff.
Okay. Check out other stuff. If they're not there yet, then you can, well, we'll get to this, but you're on Twitter, obviously.
Yeah.
You can like hound her to post them on her website.
I will post. Yeah.
Cool. So, okay. Before we go and before we do all the fun plugs, all the additional fun plugs, I want to ask you the same final two questions that I ask everybody who comes on my show.
Okay.
So they are, when you think about sort of the future in a context that's relevant for you, you're a young mom, but you also have a book out. You also are super curious about all of these fascinating things. You have your interests, but, you know, you think about things in your own family. You think about big picture things. So anywhere in that milieu, number one, what is the thing that kind of keeps you up the most at night? What is the thing that you're legitimately like really concerned about, maybe even pessimistic or cynical about? But on the flip side of that, what is the thing, if you had to pick one, which is hard, that you are genuinely excited, optimistic, like not just playing lip service, but you're actually really, you know, looking forward to when you think about the future?
Oh my goodness.
I know, they're pure evil.
Are these two questions? Or is there like another one after that?
No, these are the final two. Some people I find that it'll be the same thing, but like viewed differently. And for other people, it's two.
I mean, I don't know what to say, because like keeping me up at night, like that could be like something I said. That I'm like, fuck, why did I say that? I should have said this other thing.
Are you a ruminator?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So does that mean, okay, I have a question about this. Do you have a good memory?
No.
You don't? Interesting.
No.
Not a good autobiographical memory. Like you can't remember who was where and what you were wearing. And
I mean, it depends on the moment. If it was a thing that I said that I didn't think I should have said, then yes, I can remember everything.
It's funny because I don't remember. I'm horrible. I have a horrible autobiographical memory. I almost never think about things after they've happened.
Okay.
I have a good declarative memory for like facts and figures and stuff, but like shit where I was in a conversation, I'll be like, I don't even remember meeting that human being.
Oh, well, that's nice.
I just never think about the past.
Yeah. Wow. I had an All Things Considered interview that hasn't aired yet, and it was terrifying to me. So I've been up at night thinking about that for like kind of 2 weeks straight of being like, why couldn't I be smoother? Why did I not talk when Elsa Chang asked me a question? I was just like,
But that's so common, right? Doesn't everybody feel that way? Everybody, maybe for some reason.
I've just been so scared of it coming out because I have no idea what it's going to sound like. So that's me.
By the way, All Things Considered, that's fucking badass.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't get bumped. We'll see.
It won't. It's so funny. They're not going to bump it. Okay.
But I don't know if I was funny because I don't remember what I said because I blacked out.
That's good, though. That means you were like being your truest self.
I don't know. Gosh, you know, that's such a hard question. I mean, I feel like I should say something like really like straws. Like I'm nervous about straws clogging up the oceans, but I also really love straws.
That's fair. I carry straws now like a crazy person in LA who has like a bundle of straws in my purse.
Because you're like, I need a straw.
Yeah. So I have metal ones and glass ones and rubber ones.
Oh, that's great. What's your favorite?
I actually like metal because they're firm and you can drink anything with them, like a milkshake even. They don't collapse. But if you have sensitive teeth like I do, you have to be a little careful.
Okay.
Because they can like kind of hurt. But metal's my favorite. Glass is good, but I worry because I leave them in my cups sometimes at restaurants.
To break.
I'm like, damn it. That was like kind of expensive.
And that'd be scary to carry around if it breaks.
Yeah, I don't know. So far they haven't broken.
But that's so bold and like taking action.
I try. Yeah. I have those. I have a little thing of bamboo cutlery, and then I have a reusable bag all in the bottom of my purse.
You're amazing.
But the truth is we're all going to have to do it soon. It's already banned in Oregon or Washington? San Francisco, maybe.
I thought I had the greatest Etsy idea was to like make something that people are supposed to bring to restaurants to take home their leftovers. Like,
yes,
but like it's collapsible.
Yes.
And it's, you know, cute.
That's a genius idea. And if you could also make with it a carrying case for reusable straws.
Yes.
Because none of them are good. I can't find a good one online.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Please, that's a great side project. Next step on the list. Yeah.
No, but the straw thing is probably not true. I just, it's not. I just don't even know if I can answer this. There's so many things. There are so many things.
Yeah. And it's just like the first question is much easier for people. And then when it's like, but what are you excited about? They're like,
I mean, I'm excited for a lot of things.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited for like my babies to start to talk to each other and like, hug each other. That'll be cool. Instead of take toys from each other.
How cool to have twins.
I know. It's crazy. It's a boy and a girl.
Ugh.
And it was such a surprise. And they're just like mind-boggling cool. And so, I didn't even know if I wanted to have kids. And then I cried for like 2 months when I found out I was twins.
That's fair.
Yeah. And then I got with it. And I was like, okay, this is cool.
And now they're little, like they are miniature science experiments.
Yeah.
And the cool shit that kids do, like watching them learn.
Yeah.
Or learn to speak. That's super cool.
Yeah, so far we just have like, nana, nana. Oh,
just over and over.
Nana. I'm like, buh, banana. It's banana.
Did you see that YouTube video trending? Or maybe it was an Instagram video. I don't know, but it's trending of like the little baby who can't say happiness. And the mom's like, happiness is a British
thing.
Oh,
and he's like, penis?
Yeah, he's like, happy penis.
That's great.
It's so good.
That's really funny.
Love it.
Yeah.
That's totally an amazing answer, I think. Being excited about your own progeny.
Yeah, it's like very like nuclear. It's very inward, which I'm not like that proud about because I, you know.
But it's why our species has existed for so long. You know what
kinda,
I mean?
Yeah, it's just kind of true.
Like I'm not contributing to the continuation of, you know, the human species, but you are. And I think that there's something that's very paradoxically, like you said, inward and nuclear and massively big picture about it at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is super cool.
Yeah. It's kind of like how bacteria are inside your vagina, eating your liquids and kind of spitting them out like they're pooping. So they're pooping in an area like where you're kind of pooping. It's very meta.
It is very meta. And it's a beautiful thing, goddammit. Mara, this was so much fun. Guys, her book is Gross Anatomy, Dispatches from the Front and Back. And you can buy it anywhere books are sold. You can go to your local bookstore. I highly recommend it, but you can also buy it on Amazon. And where can people find you? Where can they figure out your, you know, your new writings, read all about it, watch your videos, all that good
stuff?
Yeah,
mara-altman.com. And probably more up to date would be my Instagram, just Mara Altman.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the Instagram right now. The little stories and stuff.
They're fun.
That's pretty fun.
Yeah. I'm more of a lurker.
Okay, yeah.
I post, but not very often because I'm not a picture person.
I'm not good at Twitter, even though I'm trying, but I just really haven't figured it out.
That's fair. I'm more Twitter than Insta, but I'm both. Okay. Everyone's kind of all of them, right? And we're all on Facebook, but hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, but I don't know. I just don't know.
I feel you. That's the toughest one for me. So good. Insta, read the books.
Thanks for having me. This is wonderful. I want to really learn more about what you're doing with this.
We will continue this conversation for sure. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was so much fun.
Thank you.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.